This oral history compilation was commissioned in 2009 by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. It was recorded and edited by Frank Hymans from original interviews with 29 persons involved in every aspect of road safety. The opinions expressed in the interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.
Road safety is about essentially reducing loss of life, reducing debilitating injury on our roads by creating a transport system and a road system that allows for human error, that accepts that human error will occur but should not result in those severe consequences.
I believe our definition of road safety should be that no crash is acceptable. And I think we should leave no stone unturned in reducing crashes to the absolute minimum we can.
I think road safety for all road users is abiding by the rules, but also using the road environment in a way that doesn't place yourself or others at risk.
I tend to think of it in terms of the behavioural side, in terms of influencing the behaviour or influencing the environment in which the behaviour takes place.
If you're looking to protect people, you have to look more widely than just at human behaviour. You look at the whole system and you look at how the human behaviour interacts with the roads and with the vehicle in order not only to prevent crashes occurring, but also to reduce the effects of those crashes when they do occur. A total systems approach.
To me, road safety is something that has to be balanced with mobility, because people that are somewhat single-minded about road safety, I think, forget that at the end of the day, we still have to allow people to travel around. And if we wanted to have perfect road safety score, we'd probably have to prevent people moving from A to B at all. And how realistic is that?
I see road safety as a whole set of very carefully researched, designed and implemented measures that target driver behaviour and the driving environment, that's roads and vehicles, to address road trauma. Now, one of the things with road safety is that we're not interested in property damage. Road safety is all about people. It's about people killed or people injured. We are a public health area. We are interested in people. That's what road safety is. It's about people.
The modern history of road safety is a fascinating one. It began in England in the 19th century with the introduction of the Highway Code, in which road traffic was required to keep to the left. Dr. John Knott is a social historian at the Australian National University who has made a study of the history of motoring in Australia.
It's often forgotten by many people that you could die on the roads before the motor car. And in fact, that did happen. For instance, in 1901 in New South Wales, there were 130 deaths on the roads, and none of them were associated with the motor car. About 44% of them were buggy, cart and wagon accidents. 36% were people who were run down, thrown, kicked or fell off their horse while drunk. 2% were bicycle deaths. These are the days when the bicycle was the harbinger of modernity, and young men in particular would travel quite high speed, sometimes downhill, without adequate brakes, and they came a cropper as a result. 18% were killed by trams in and around Sydney, the old steam trams that were first introduced, and then later on electric trams.
Andy Graham is the RTA's principal road safety statistician. He recounts the story of the first recorded motor car fatality.
It was a middle-aged woman who was hit by a car travelling at the tremendously high speed of 4 miles per hour. But it was a classic road safety crash, and you just wonder how relevant it is today. And the information for the crash was, it occurred on a London road in 1896. The driver only recently learnt how to drive that machine, only 3 weeks previous. So there were no licences back then. So he'd apparently tampered with the driver of the machine to make the car go twice the intended speed. And he was also said to have been talking to the female passenger next to him. And if you translate that, you think, well, That's exactly the sort of young person crash you get these days. Travelling at high speed, talking to the passenger next to them, and they've modified the vehicle. The coroner held an inquiry, and the verdict of that particular incident was described as accidental death, and then rather presciently said in his conclusions, this must never happen again.
The first recorded Australian motor car crash fatality occurred in 1905.
It involves a young man by the name of Samuel Payne. He's a draper and he's pedalling his racing bike into Melbourne, where he works in a drapery store. And on the 5th of January 1905, he's crossing an intersection where a motor car appears on his right-hand side. He attempts to get across the intersection before the motor car, doesn't make it. He runs into the side of the car, in fact, and is thrown off his bicycle and lands on his head. He's put into the back of the car by the driver and the passenger, and they whisk him off to the Melbourne hospital, but unfortunately he died that afternoon. And he's the first official fatality on the roads involving a motor car.
Road fatality statistics for the first 20 years of the 20th century provide a fascinating insight into a society on the verge of a monumental change in mobility.
The first thing that jumps out here is that pedestrians are the main victims of motor car accidents. The figures from 1900 to 1920, over 50% of all people killed on the roads by motor vehicles are pedestrians. Drivers, as people killed in early motor car accidents, are quite low statistically at the very beginning of the motoring age. It's pedestrians and young people, particularly children. Children are overrepresented in relation to their proportion of the population right through until the 1920s as well.
And did that change? That's crazy?
Yes, it does. It changes in the 1920s. The reasons are not quite clear, but I'd speculate that it was the early education programs that were introduced for school children. In South Australia in 1918, in fact, they introduced the first safety curriculum. By the 1920s, all primary school children across all the states, all the jurisdictions in Australia, are having lessons, being warned about the dangers of the road, and the campaign, as it was targeting school children, is called Safety First. And Safety First was taught to children in Australian primary schools. By the mid-20s, overseas some important things are happening. The first road traffic campaign is in the United States in 1924, where the slogan, which lives on for a long time, we will find it in Australia in the 50s as well. The slogan was enforcement, education and engineering. That was 1924. 1925 in Victoria, the RACV established the first Road Safety Week. They devote the whole of the first week of March 1925 to an emphasis on road safety. That same year, 1925, Safety First Association is formed in Australia, and they would promote road safety campaigns right around Australia. By the 30s, graphic publicity campaigns about road safety are introduced. One, at the time, notorious poster was of a motorist holding the body of a young girl and saying, "What have I done?" The NRMA in New South Wales objected to the use of this poster, saying that it would make drivers nervous and therefore worse drivers on the roads. There'd be a whole debate about how graphic you should be in advertising if you were going to promote road safety. But from the 20s onwards, we start to see a real growing concern in the community by public leaders about road safety, not just in Australia, overseas as well.
Has the way that we conceptualise road safety changed over time?
Yes, it has. The oldest conceptualisation, and still one that's very prominent, is what I think of as the accident paradigm. That is that somehow road traffic accidents are part of life. It's a matter of luck or ill luck whether you have an accident or not. And in a sense, nothing can be done about it. So you don't do much about it, other than perhaps have faith in superstition, carry a lucky charm with you, or perhaps say prayers. There was a strong movement in the 1950s in churches in Australia to have prayers, to pray for better behaviour and safety on the road. The Catholic Church had young people take a pledge that they would behave safely on the road, and they were still doing that in the 1960s.
The notion that fate determined a crash was stood on its head during World War I by Hugh de Haven, a Canadian pilot engaged in aerial combat. The story is told by medical doctor Michael Henderson, a road safety pioneer.
He was absolutely fundamental in starting a way of thinking that says that it's not just human behaviour that causes injury and death, it's other things that combine with human behaviour. When flying, he came into collision with another aircraft and they both crashed. He survived and the pilot of the other aircraft did not survive. And instead of saying, well, act of God, just luck, whatever, he started by thinking, well, why is this so? Why did I survive and he didn't? I mean, we both crashed our aircraft in very similar circumstances. His way of thinking developed into a concept which is completely accepted now, which was really groundbreaking at that time, which is the concept that if you package a person in the way that you package a vase, if you send it in the mail, then that person may not be injured in incidents or accidents, as they used to be called, that were potentially injurious, didn't have to be. They didn't have to kill people, so that even quite violent crashes, incidents in aircraft, trains, cars, racing cars, they didn't have to result in death and injury. And it wasn't just a matter of luck. It was a matter, possibly in the future, of applying science to this kind of thought, which would make life safer even for risk takers or people in dangerous occupations. That all happened, and that's why de Haven's original thought was so fundamental. And he had the influence on pretty much everybody who moved into the field in the next several decades.
And why did he actually survive and the other pilot did not? Is there any rationale?
Well, it was a combination of things. It was a combination of he did have a lap belt on. The instruments that he came into contact with were not as injurious as the instruments that in the cockpit that the other pilot came into contact with, and he compared the cockpits and with the injuries and so forth. And he realised that if the cockpits had been made safer and the pilots in the future were all properly restrained, including the use of shoulder belts, which hadn't been used at all at that time, then people could survive quite severe accidents. It was just, in that case, it was just a fundamental comparing of two outcomes from similar crash, which of course is a concept that applies all the time now in crash investigation.
The next paradigm shift in thinking about road safety came about when a medical doctor in the US, William Haddon, took up de Haven's mantle and brought the concept of a public health approach to the road safety field. He created what is known today as the Haddon Matrix. Dr. David Saffron, a former manager of road user safety at the RTA and a specialist in road safety evaluation strategy, takes up the story.
The matrix breaks road safety problems or road safety countermeasures into 9 cells based on 3 types of factors. The 3 factors are the human factor, vehicle factor, and the third one's called the environment factor, which is a little bit vague, but it includes the roadway and its environment. And the other 3 phases, there's the pre-crash, the in-crash, and the post-crash. So the pre-crash would be things that one could do to actually prevent the crash. So if you were to put non-skid surface on the road, that would be a road factor that would help to prevent a crash. In-crash would be ensuring that when the crash happens, people aren't injured. So jutting hard projections within a vehicle interior would be removed to try and prevent the injuries. And the post-crash was things to ensure that people could perhaps be rescued from the vehicle or allowing access for emergency vehicles and training people in first aid, etc. In the past, Haddon said that the main emphasis had been on the first cell, which was the human pre-crash cell. And the matrix helps us to think beyond that. We're just not trying to change humans to prevent crashes. We're doing a lot more things to prevent injury. That's the difference that Haddon emphasised and brought into being in road safety.
Another trailblazer in Australian road safety was Dr. John Lane, also a medical doctor. A former chairman of the Victorian Road Safety Authority, Dr. Peter Vulcan, recalls.
Dr. John Lane was important in my life and probably in the life of a number of other road safety research people. He was Director of Aviation Medicine. He'd actually served in the Royal Australian Air Force as a medico up in New Guinea, and he founded the aviation medicine branch of the Department of Civil Aviation. I guess it must have been in 1945. His primary job, of course, was screening of pilots for medical conditions, but he became interested in promoting crashworthiness of aircraft. In fact, he's attributed as having invented the word crashworthiness, meaning ability to protect in a crash. He was also the medical monitor for the United States Project Mercury, which involved astronauts circling the globe, and he was responsible for monitoring their medical signs as they passed over Australia. And in the case if communications with the US broke down, he was solely responsible for making the decision to bring them down out of orbit if necessary. The road safety spin-off of that was that John was able to go to the States before and after each of the launches and was able to bring back to Australia a huge pile of road safety literature. And when I got interested in crash protection, both for aircraft and on the road, in the mid-60s, the best source in Australia was a filing cabinet full of literature in John Lane's office.
By 1959, road safety had become a pressing social issue, and the Senate set up a select committee of inquiry into road safety in Australia and heard from a number of experts.
John Lane appeared at that Senate inquiry, and he brought in with him William Haddon's Matrix. And at that inquiry, he absolutely astonished the senators because they were still thinking in terms of enforcement. They were still thinking about regulations and rules. And here was a man who was saying, no, this is a public health problem, and it has to be approached in the same way as any major public health issue. That is, that there's an epidemic going on here, and that we have to look at the various causes, the various factors. We have to look at the survivability rates of vehicles, the conditions on the road. We have to look at the driver. We have to look at so many other factors here. But it is doable. It's doable scientifically, and that's an approach that started to come in the 1960s in Australia about road safety.
In the 1950s, interest in road safety had also been growing in the United States. By this time, Uta Haven had set up an automotive crash injury research program at Cornell University Medical College in New York. Professor Jack McLean, then a young Adelaide researcher, was fortunate enough to be sent there in the mid-1960s to take part in crash investigation.
Teams of trainers were sent out to various counties throughout the United States. And these trainers would train the police to record information on every 10th crash that resulted in somebody going to hospital. And they would go to the doctors at the hospital and train them on how to record injuries for this purpose. They gave the police cameras, which in the 1950s was quite remarkable. And in the life of that program, which ran until the late 60s, they investigated about 60,000 crashes in that way.
What were some of the main findings of the early United States crash investigations? What did they discover about injuries?
The most important thing they discovered was that if you got thrown out of the car, the risk of serious or fatal injury was increased greatly. And they were able to show that most people who got ejected from a car were ejected because the doors came open. And at that time, in the early to mid-1950s, the door latch on a car door was just like the door latch in a house. And if the body structure of the car was distorted or deformed in the crash, the doors just popped open. So quite a minor change was made to car door latches by including what the term is longitudinal restraint, but it meant that if the body of the car did distort and try to pull away from the door itself, the door latch was designed to resist this. And in the 1956 model year, all of the major car manufacturers in the United States changed their door latches. And this has proved to be probably one of the major public health reforms of all time. It was hugely important, but an almost trivial change in car design.
In 1961, McLean conducted the very first detailed crash investigation studies in Australia at the University of Adelaide, funded by the Australian Road Research Board. How much crash investigation was being done? Was anyone else in Australia doing any at that time?
No, it was the first time anywhere in the world that a study had attempted to look at a representative sample of crashes. They were very much team studies. We were able to hire two teams of researchers, each with a medical doctor, an engineer and a psychologist. We set out to record a sample of crashes to which an ambulance was called, where the sample had the same distribution by time of day and day of week as all accidents. In other words, representative by time of day and day of week.
How many items of information would you collect?
I once made an estimate for a two-car crash with two people in each car. There were about 3,000 items of information. But by items of information, that would include information on specific injuries, and one occupant might have a dozen injuries, and an estimate of the objects or object causing those injuries. But it was very, very detailed.
So how would those studies rate against any other studies that have been done on that subject?
It is still the most detailed representative study of crashes conducted at the scene of the crash that has ever taken place.
Anywhere in the world?
Yes, anywhere in the world.
And how many crashes did you investigate, do you think?
Over 2 years, just over 400. We were looking for information on anything that we thought might be relevant to why the crash had happened or why the injuries occurred in the crash. And at that time, we would occasionally go back to the scene of the crash. Sometimes we would go and have a look at the car in the crash repair yards.
Now, we're talking here of the 1960s, and cars weren't all that great yet. Tell me what sort of injuries these people might have suffered as a result of being inside that car.
Cars were much less safe than they are today, and I think of just one head-on collision in the Adelaide Parklands at night between a large utility, and I still have the colour slide showing teeth marks in a metal dashboard of a young lady whose face hit the dashboard, and the other car was a Volkswagen Beetle, and the steering wheel and steering column were pushed up about a foot, and the driver was a quadriplegic. Neither of those things happen anymore. Steering columns don't come back and hit the driver under the chin, and dashboards are padded.
Some of the American cars that were built in those days were almost like lethal weapons, weren't they?
Oh, there wasn't much to choose depending on where the car came from. I think the attitude of many car manufacturers at that time could almost be summed up by Alex Isogonis, who designed the Mini, which of course was a very small car when it came out. Was once asked how well would his car protect an occupant in a crash, and his response was that he did not design his cars to have accidents. The car industry has come a long way since those days.
Must be very difficult when you come to a crash scene. It's already happened. How do you reconstruct what happened? What clues do you use?
It's actually quite a profound question. There is a difference between looking and seeing. Two people could go to a crash scene, and someone who is entirely new to going to a crash would be looking at the same things that a more experienced investigator would be looking at, but not see the same things, if that makes sense. We place a great deal of importance on recording what the situation was immediately after the crash, preferably before the vehicles are moved. And so we, where necessary, mark the road. As soon as we arrive, we photograph things, both still and video photography. Then, as far as reconstructing what happened in the crash, there are computer programs that do that fairly accurately. As far as injuries are concerned, in a pedestrian accident, it's usually fairly easy to see what part of the car contacted the pedestrian, and we record that as accurately as we can. For people inside the car, we look for evidence of contact between the occupants and the inside of the vehicle. As far as reconstructing the motion of the vehicles in the crash, there are computer packages that are very useful in doing that. With the computer package, we can estimate fairly accurately the speeds of the vehicles on impact. In some cases, we can also estimate the travelling speeds of the vehicles. But we also look at the general road and traffic environment to see if there's anything that might have helped the driver to have the crash.
Ralph Nader in the United States wrote a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, in which he criticized the design of motor cars in America at that time. Tell me, what was the fallout from the publication of that book?
Well, from my point of view, I would never have ended up in the United States if he hadn't written that book. What happened was he criticised a particular car made by General Motors, the Corvair, and by coincidence, at about that time, US Congress had appointed a committee to consider whether the United States government should get into the road safety area, which they did eventually with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. But the Congressional Committee, which was chaired by Abraham Ribicoff from Connecticut and had Bobby Kennedy as a member, called witnesses, and Nader was a witness. And it had become obvious that somebody was trying to collect information that could have been used to blackmail Nader. Glamorous blondes were coming up to him in the drugstore saying they'd just moved into the area and could he help move their furniture. And James Roach, the president of General Motors, appeared before the committee and was asked, did he know anything about putting a tail, as they say, on Nader? And he indignantly denied it. The next day, he asked for permission to appear again before the committee and said, to his dismay, he found General Motors had hired the detective agency. Now, this resulted in Congress voting to establish what became the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, with fewer dissenting votes than any bill put before Congress other than the decision to declare war on Japan after Pearl Harbor. So if the car industry or General Motors hadn't misbehaved, life could have been quite different.
But what were the implications for Australian road safety of Ralph Nader's book? Peter Vulcan elaborates.
Ralph Nader actually came out to Australia and addressed a meeting, and I guess that gave some impetus to vehicle safety in Australia, in that John Permazel, who was then with the Commonwealth Department of Transport, established a committee to formulate Australian safety standards for new cars.
Those safety standards became part of the first Australian design rules for motor vehicles. They also included standards for seatbelts and anchorages. The history of seatbelts in Australia started in the 1950s. John Knott.
Sir William Hudson, who was in charge of the Snowy Mountain Authority, becomes concerned about road safety for his own workers, has seatbelts fitted to all Snowy Mountain vehicles, and orders all employees to wear the seatbelts, which is important. It's one thing to fit them, it's another thing to wear them. If they found not wearing a seatbelt, they're given a warning. If they found again not to be wearing it, they were actually dismissed. And what happens in the Snowy Mountains Authority is that fatalities from road traffic accidents almost drop to zero.
In 1967, David Herbert, a scientist on the Snowy Mountains scheme, chaired the committee that was determining the standards for seatbelt wearing in Australia. Peter Vulcan.
The Standards Committee, at the stage of comment on the standard, had quite an altercation with the Ford Motor Company, because the standard specified that you had to have upper torso restraint, usually provided by a diagonal, and that diagonal should not be capable of being disconnected from the lap belt. In America, it was allowed to disconnect the diagonal, and if you stepped into most American cars, they were using the lap belt, and the diagonal portion of the belt was still in its original wrapping along the roof rail. Ford said, you don't need them. We stuck to our guns based on the Swedish research that showed that you did need upper torso restraint. Otherwise, your head went crashing into the dashboard or the steering wheel, and we won that battle, and Australia has always had upper torso restraint right since the word go.
An important impetus for seatbelts occurred in motor car racing in England in 1967. Michael Henderson had joined the Royal Air Force to work in aviation medicine, but he also happened to be a racing car driver on the European circuit.
I flew as much as possible with combat aircrew. I trained as a parachutist and became a parachute rescue medical officer. And then later in that period, I became an instructor at an aviation medicine institute, and one of the things we did was training aircrew in high-altitude physiology, because the RAF was very much into V-bombers, as they were called, flying at extremely high altitude, and survival and other aspects of the medical sciences as they applied to aircrew. And at that time, I started coming to understand the principles of protection from injury, in other words, the science of safety. I'd subsequently been asked, how does someone who races cars and parachutes and does other kinds of stupid things, how come you become a safety expert? Well, I became a safety expert because I did risky things. I accept the tag of a risk taker, but people can get away with taking risks by managing those risks, and you become very interested in safety. I was still racing cars during that whole period, and I began to understand that some of the principles of safety that were being applied in aviation could well be applied to other activities such as racing cars. Motorsport was a sport in which you were likely to be killed. I mean, the death rate in Formula One drivers at the time was something like a death rate in Battle of Britain fighter pilots. But everybody accepted that. The sport was so exciting, so challenging. People did it despite all that.
In 1966 and 1967, Henderson researched every reported incident in motor car racing in Britain. That led him, in 1968, to publish his seminal book, Motor Car Racing in Safety, The Human Factor. To further prove his point, he designed and raised funds to build a racing car that contained a strong inner capsule in which drivers were restrained by a multi-point racing harness. It was a revolutionary concept in motorsport, and one that had important implications for the introduction of seatbelts in all motor vehicles.
At that time, no racing car drivers in Europe in open cars were wearing any kind of seatbelt. It was regarded as safer to be thrown out. Well, I proved that was wrong from the research I did in 1967, but I was the first one to show that. So we'd now got the driver strapped into the centre capsule, and then we built outside that crushable structures to ease the shock loadings in a crash. We added fire protection, because fire was a terrible thing then. Many drivers died in fires. So we built in a fire extinguishing system. We put aircraft-style tanks in, which by that time were already resistant to being damaged with a great outflow of fuel. We introduced a concept which didn't come into widespread use for decades afterwards, and that was to restrain the head and neck of the driver so that, having restrained the body, the head wasn't going to flick forward and break the neck. We demonstrated that in 1969 as well. And that, I think, was a revolutionary concept. There's no question of that. There was nothing like it had been done before, nothing like it has been done since. The concepts there are exactly the same now as they are in modern Formula One racing cars, and the concepts are exactly the same as they are in modern road cars as well. That of central strong structure, crushable outer structures, full restraint, rollover protection, and so on. And every one of those concepts since then has been built into the rules for international motor racing.
And how long did it actually take for that harness to become generally accepted by racing car drivers?
1 year. It was one of the most astonishing turnarounds in safety in any kind of human activity, particularly in an activity which is fundamentally a very high risk. 1 year it took. By the end of 1968, every Formula One car had a harness, and pretty much every other open racing car in the world had fitted harnesses by that time. Same thing happened here. The astonishing turnaround was during 1968 in Europe, and by that time I was in Australia, and the same thing happened here, exactly the same. It was a snowball effect.
Having proved that seatbelts saved lives, Henderson arrived in Australia in 1968 and settled in Sydney, where the road safety fraternity was searching for an inspirational leader. The New South Wales Department of Motor Transport had recently set up a traffic accident research unit known as TARU, and Henderson was appointed as its first director. At this time, the New South Wales government was considering introducing compulsory seatbelt wearing, and TARU was directed to carry out the research prior to its implementation.
We wanted to know, well, what kind of backlash might there be if we did introduce it? And what we found out was that even among people who never wore a seatbelt, there was no strong opposition to making it compulsory. And in fact, there was a feeling that for people who never wore seatbelts because of whatever reason, laziness or peer pressure, or a regulation would make them wear a seatbelt, and they realised that was a good thing to do. And so they were happy to accept that regulation, and it eased the pressures on them. And a lot of people did feel pressures not to wear a seatbelt. If a passenger puts a seatbelt on, it's a message to the driver, I don't trust you. And that was something that was quite strong at the time.
Peter Croft is a former manager of road environment safety at the RTA and presently principal research scientist, Safe Systems, with the Australian Road Research Board.
In the early 70s, compulsory seatbelt wearing was coming in. One heard obvious complaints from sectors of the community about loss of freedom, inhibition of their activities if they were vehicle-based workplaces and so on. Sectors of the transport industry, like taxis and heavy vehicle drivers, seemed to be against it, didn't see the need for them to have it because they were professionals and it didn't matter.
John Knott adds this insightful anecdote.
One of the things that's quite clear from the seatbelt history in Victoria is that the Victorian police themselves, particularly the detective force, did not want to crush their suits by wearing seatbelts in a vehicle. In fact, in some cases, they seem to have taken out their seatbelts, which, when they were fitted the car, you could do.
However, strong community pressures to mandate seatbelt wearing prevailed, especially in Victoria. Ray Taylor, a former general manager of road safety at the RTA, recalls.
There was a key part of the process which was put in place in Victoria and ultimately put in place in every other state, which was the notion of having a parliamentary committee devoted to road safety that could inquire into safety issues on a non-party type basis. The initial committee in Victoria is called the Social Development Committee, and they supported very strongly, for example, the seatbelt legislation. And they supported inquiries into a wide range of initiatives. And out of that have come consistent recommendations for the various authorities to undertake.
The compulsory wearing of seatbelts passed into law in Victoria on the 1st of January 1971. And by the end of that year, every state in Australia had followed suit. The effect on the road toll was soon evident.
There was a huge reduction in vehicle occupant injuries and deaths in the 12 months after the introduction of the law. It was very interesting. There was a wearing rate of about 20% before the law was introduced. The day after the law was passed in Victoria, without any enforcement, that wearing rate went up to about 50%. A lot of people were waiting for an excuse to be forced to wear the belt. Getting up to 90-95% took quite a few years of publicity and rigorous enforcement.
Dr. Soames Job is the director of the Centre for Road Safety at the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.
Seatbelts are a really good example of the success of enforcement. So prior to introducing compulsory seatbelt wearing in New South Wales, we had many advertising campaigns telling people seatbelts would improve their safety, save them in a crash, etc. But the seatbelt wearing rate remained very low. We introduced compulsory seatbelt wearing, which essentially was an enforcement threat. It says, if you don't wear your seatbelt, we'll fine you $50. Suddenly, the seatbelt wearing rate went to way over 90%. And so because of the enforcement, we went from a small number of people wearing their seatbelts to over 90%. The effect of enforcement on behaviour is very powerful.
However, seatbelt design had not yet been perfected. Bruce Dowdell, currently Senior Environmental Specialist in the Environment Branch at the RTA, explains.
The original seatbelts were really just a strap that you clipped into a buckle and you then adjusted that so that the fit was comfortable. And that style of seatbelt had quite a few problems in terms of its effectiveness. And the biggest issue was that many people just left the belt loose in the belief that the belt was on, so therefore it could do its job. But that was a false belief. The loose seatbelt could be quite dangerous, actually. It would allow you to move forward a distance in a crash and then suddenly come to a stop against that seatbelt. The solution to that was to move towards retractable seatbelts so that when you buckled the seatbelt up, there was a retractor spring that tensioned the belt so that it fit snugly against the occupant. And those belts were a very significant advance. They got over that reluctance of people to keep adjusting belts for different passengers and drivers. And for a time, they were an excellent solution. But as time went on, it became clear that the belts could do an even better job. If the seat belt mechanism sensed that an accident was happening and was able to tighten the belt up so that it really strapped the occupant into the car, then that would mean that you could gain even more of that time as the car collapsed. So seatbelts started being developed that had explosive devices in the rewinding mechanism that would actually tighten the belt as you went into a crash. So the whole science of seatbelt design became much more sophisticated.
Dr. Graham Brisbane is an expert in vehicle technology, practices and research.
Back in the early 2000s, they found that accidents were happening from internal injuries, and it worked out that the seatbelts were too good. So a combination of seatbelts and airbags were stopping the body, but the internal organs were suffering too high a degree of deceleration. And that in turn led to the improvements in the seatbelts, in the inertia seatbelts that gradually decelerate you instead of the sudden stop, the instantaneous stop.
Michael Griffiths is a renowned road safety consultant.
It was a big problem with seatbelts in heavy vehicles. Drivers wouldn't wear them because the retractors in heavy vehicles, they have a suspension seat. Notice the suspension seat would go up and down. The retractor would tighten progressively on the driver and it would become uncomfortable. So what we said, well, this is pretty straightforward. All we've got to do is make the seatbelts less sensitive in their locking. So that became part of a total national review process and eventually resulted in a revised Australian design rule for seatbelts in trucks. Then, once that had been in place for a while, there was then changes in the road rules, which removed the exemption for seatbelt wearing for heavy vehicle drivers, because up until that time, heavy vehicle drivers had an exemption. So we fixed the engineering aspects of it, and then you could change the rules in terms of behaviour.
Professor Ian Johnston is a former director of the Monash University Accident Research Centre.
We've now got 97% of drivers wear their seatbelts all the time. 25% of drivers who die don't have their seatbelts on. So the last 3% is, and you know, the physics is inescapable, but the kind of people who won't wear their belts take more risks than the kind of people who do, so they're more likely to have a crash, and of course in a crash they're more likely to die. So we aren't going to get from 97% to 100% with more education or more enforcement or convincing people to be nice. The only way we're going to get to 100% is through vehicle design. Let's have a car that won't start unless all the belts are on, that kind of thing. We've agitated for years to get a decent seatbelt warning system in place so that if you forget to put your belt on, the car will tell you. And the manufacturer said, oh, yeah, we did that. But when you look at it, all it did was light up a tiny little red stick figure and go beep, beep, beep for 3 seconds. And if you didn't put it on, it didn't care. It stopped. Now we're finally getting to systems that will emit very high frequency noises continuously until you put your belt on.
Michael Payne is a chartered professional engineer and road safety consultant. How much have seatbelts contributed to a reduction in the fatality rate?
The estimates I hear are about a third. So a third of all fatalities have been prevented by seatbelts. And in fact, it shows up in our current crash statistics where the risk of dying in a crash is about 4 or 5 times higher for a person who's not wearing a seatbelt.
In the early 1970s, Michael Henderson was forming TARU. He put together road professionals, traffic engineers, psychologists, vehicle technologists and medicos in order to bring a scientific approach to road safety.
At that time, there was an explosion of interest. And a lot of scientists who had been working around the field came into the field and concentrated on road safety. They could see that this was an area of human endeavour where there was huge, huge gains to be made.
Bruce Dowdell remembers.
That was a very interesting period working with or being associated with Dr. Henderson, who I felt always had a very clear picture of where he wanted to get to and worked from a strong evidence base investigation. You base your actions upon your findings. And he was also very open to a multidisciplinary approach. So we were dealing with behavioural scientists and a range of different professionals, and he was moving away from the concept that there was right and wrong involved in accidents, that bad people had accidents, good people didn't. It was more a question of designing the road system and the vehicles so that if people did have an accident, they didn't suffer excessively for the human mistakes.
In 1976, Michael Griffiths, equipped with a master's degree in biomedical engineering, became part of the Tyro team, spending the next 6 years in crash investigation.
We were 12 people who were hired from outside, so we hadn't been institutionalised in the then Traffic Accident Research Unit or the Department of Motor Transport. And we didn't start at head office, we started at Fairfield. Basically occupied our own space on top of a motor registry at Fairfield. And we weren't that focused on strict letter of the law in terms of all the rules for the organisation. We were more focused on getting the job done. The group became known as the Dirty Dozen because of that. But it was a highly motivated group.
They were the Fairfield in-depth crash studies, and they were a real Rolls-Royce type of study. They had collections of engineers and psychologists and other traffic-type people to go out the scene of crashes, take measurements, record information and so on. That work was invaluable in working out the key mechanisms and the timing sequence of those mechanisms in the crash sequence.
The ambulance would phone us up when they had a crash and we'd head off. But it was learn on the job. So when there was no one in the teams who'd done it before. So a lot of the early months were just really learning how to go about it. But the one thing that was planned was that there would be someone looking at the vehicle contribution, someone looking at the road and the environment contribution, and someone looking at the behavioural contribution. My job was in the area of the vehicles, looking at what the vehicle's role was in terms of its condition that might lead up to the crash, but really subsequently, more importantly, how people got injured inside the vehicles.
Are there any crashes that particularly stand out in your memory?
I remember going to the first fatal and from that learning that we needed to be able to be better emotionally prepared. Then I remember going to another fatal truck crash at Wagga, I think. This was sort of one of those coincidences you'd think couldn't happen, but did. There was one semi-trailer overtaking another northbound semi-trailer and simultaneously coming in the opposite direction, a southbound semi-trailer overtaking another southbound semi-trailer. And they came around the bend and all four trucks had nowhere to go and it was just all up in smoke. We got down there reasonably quickly. The police officer asking if I wanted to go to the autopsy and I didn't. And I felt that that was an inadequacy on my part. So after that, I made contact with the forensic pathology people in Sydney and started to go to post-mortems to be better personally prepared for dealing with that kind of thing. And that led me to, when I later on got into management, to persuading my staff to do the same thing.
One of the areas of concern for road safety was child restraints.
In the area of child restraints, in those days, they were really almost ejector seats. They raised the child up a little bit. Many of them actually assisted the child's ejection from the car in a crash. There was a child restraint that was put into the market which had a four-point harness, and we collected information that showed that children were dying in it, not even in crashes, because they could just slide down.
Michael Henderson commissioned the building of a crash sled in which vehicle components, dummies and child restraints were tested at high impact. It proved to be invaluable.
A particular interest of mine personally was the protection of children in crashes. I mean, they're truly the innocent victims when a car crashes. And whoever's fault it is, it's never the child's fault. In Australia, as pretty much everywhere else in the Western world, the concept of restraining children was not really understood. Now, clearly, the ordinary seatbelt is unsuitable for small children. But people, what they were doing were buying seats mostly made by nursery equipment manufacturers. Many of them were not really installed in the car. They had hooks on them, which hooked over the seat back. But many of us knew how to make a better child seat, a safety seat. Several things we had to do. We had to develop an Australian standard, which represented proper safety for children. We had to get manufacturers interested so they'd make them. Government wasn't going to make them. And we had to do the testing to help manufacturers who had no idea how to do this kind of thing to develop seats that would meet with the standard that we were developing at the same time. So one way of starting this off was something that a program I did with Four Corners. What we did was done two sled runs, one with the child dummy in this basic hookover seat. We put the dummy in that, and then we ran the sled in a crash representing about 40, 50 kilometres an hour. And of course, what happened was that the seat came off, the dummy came out of the seat, and it slammed into the concrete block. This was filmed by Four Corners, and it was really a very dramatic demonstration of what would happen to a child who was either unrestrained or using one of these so-called child seats. In fact, it made them more likely to be ejected because it raised them up. They go straight through the windscreen. Everybody could see that. And then we ran a test with an early prototype seat that was properly bolted into a car. The child was properly restrained with five different straps all over. Ran it again. The dummy flops forward and sits back in the seat. Obviously, any injury would be absolutely minimal. That had a shattering effect. Now, that's the kind of public education I like. And it did have an enormous effect. The nursery equipment manufacturers then came and said, well, okay, tell us how to do this.
Michael Henderson and his team had perfected a child seat that had set a new Australian standard. Michael Payne observes.
In the late 70s, I think we started to require top tether anchorages on vehicles for child restraints. That was a world first. And it's only in the last couple of years that, for example, the USA has required these top tether anchorages on vehicles and recognised the advantages for child safety.
The Tyro team was then ready to face yet another challenge.
We realised that the child safety seats were for the protection of children up to around 4 years of age. It's still the case. But after that, there was a gap between children of, say, five and children of 10, 11-year-old, because they had to move into the use of the adult seatbelt. The main problem that we saw originally was that if you put an adult seatbelt on a 5 or 6-year-old sitting in a car seat, the belt's in the wrong place. The lap belt comes up into the stomach. The shoulder belt, the sash belt, tends to cut across the neck. Also, the child can't see out. So what you've got is an unhappy child with an unsafe seatbelt. So what we thought, well, let's raise the child up. That's the first thing, and seat them on a cushion. So we built cushions and did the sled tests. But the child, having been raised up, immediately made the seatbelt orientation better. The lap belt went back down to the hips, and the sash belt tended to go over the chest and shoulder, not the neck. So that was just by raising the child up, we solved quite a lot of things all at once. However, on the sled test, what we found was that the cushion just slipped out from underneath the child and shot off, and then the child was effectively in a loose seatbelt, so that didn't work. So then we went two ways. We developed a booster seat which hooked into the lap belt so that it couldn't slip out from under the child, and we started moving into booster seats with a back, so that was held into position by the child. And the original kind of booster seat, that was simply a cushion, that doesn't exist anymore, but the booster seat with a back is basically still what children use, and they can sit in that and use the adult seatbelt.
The team now focused their attention on protection for infants. Bruce Dardell explains.
There was no proper restraint for babies, and there was quite a long process of working with manufacturers to improve child restraints, and Paul Kelly, who worked in the laboratory, really took a close interest in that issue and worked with a number of manufacturers. He would test their devices, he'd offer suggestions as to how they could be improved. There were issues with the design, with the materials. We had some of the early plastics just couldn't withstand the impact of a crash, so they almost explode on impact. The baby restraints, the manufacturers were not actually convinced that there was a market for baby restraints. And we did quite a bit of work that really gave the manufacturers free research. But we felt it was important that this happen, otherwise these products wouldn't come onto the market. And when the first baby restraint came onto the market, they couldn't keep up with demand. And it's been the same ever since.
The baby capsule developed at Taro during the 1970s was so successful that it won the Australian Design Award and a Prince Philip Award. In Victoria, the authorities went one step further, as Ray Taylor describes.
One of the examples that became important for both baby bassinets and child car seats was that they be correctly fitted. And it was clear that a number of people were putting their children at risk. They put the seat in, but they wouldn't fit it properly, and therefore the seat could move around, or they didn't have a top tether strap, or they didn't work the seat belt into it in the appropriate fashion. So there was a series of fitting stations that were registered to provide fitting advice. Those stations all received professional training from VicRoads before they were able to undertake their task. So it was really a professional development type process. Many of the fitting stations were associated with garages that ran roadworthy certificates as well. So that was sort of like a one-stop shop. And the reason for that was because in many cases, earlier cars had to have some anchorage points put into the vehicle, and they had to be done properly, otherwise they wouldn't work. So it was a combination of those things.
To encourage parents to use the baby bassinets, the Victorian government offered the public an incentive.
The baby bassinet loan scheme was a situation where the RTA bought a whole heap of the new restraints. They were the safe and sound capsules, and made them available to the community through a loan scheme that was run at a local level by Community Health Services. And they were loaned to parents, I think, a fairly, like, might have been $10 or $20 for the six-month period where your child needed it, because after that period they were old enough to sit up. And that was an interesting program. Issues like when did the capsule stand up and when does it break down? How do you make sure they're clean so that the next baby is going into a clean bassinet? All of those sorts of things had to be dealt with in the program.
In Sydney, the Taro team now turned their attention to helmet testing.
We did quite a bit of helmet testing and quite a bit of research into helmets. We did some major studies, or particular major study, into the effectiveness of motorcyclists' helmets. We also did a lot of work on pedal cyclists' helmets, both testing and crash studies, looking at their effectiveness. A lot of that work became directed towards getting a change to the Australian standard so that the helmets worn by pedal cyclists could be lightweight and well ventilated. The old standard really led to a helmet that was like a mini motorcycle helmet. So it was heavy and uncomfortable and expensive. We were able to demonstrate through our testing and the crash studies that a helmet could be much lighter weight, could be ventilated, and still provide effective protection. And we actually developed some testing methods to help confirm that that was the case.
However, getting pedal cyclists to wear their helmets was another matter. Barry Elliott is a consulting psychologist with a special interest in road safety.
The image of somebody wearing a bicycle helmet as being a dork, and that was the main reason kids wouldn't wear them, wasn't really the inconvenience. Maybe for girls it was messing their hair up, but for guys it was all about looking like a dork. And that is why, in the long run, we recommend it. If you can make everybody look like a dork by legislating and making enforcement, that issue goes away. But I think it was the best example I can think of peer pressure working against us. And we're one of the few countries in the world with compulsory bicycle helmet wearing. The best and simplest way to change behaviour in road safety is to pass a law and enforce it. But you have to enforce it. Queensland brought in the bicycle helmet law with no penalty and no enforcement. Now, originally I passed the law, and I think they got compliance rates up to around about 80%. Within a year, it had fallen down to 20%. No penalty, no enforcement. And I remember going up there and talking to their parliamentary committee and just saying, if you want to have any effect on our behaviour change terms, there's got to be a consequence. And they brought a penalty in and police started. Because the police won't enforce something if there's no penalty. Why should they?
In Victoria, the road authorities took another tack. Ray Taylor recalls.
One of the programs that the RTA put forward was a rebate scheme where they asked people to purchase helmets. And if they purchased helmets of the right sort, with the Australian standard, they could then cut a coupon out of the newspapers that was put in advert by the RTA. And if they sent that coupon in with the detail from the standards sticker on their helmet, they then received $10 back. That got a lot of helmets out there.
In New South Wales, the Tyro team was deeply involved in other safety issues.
There was also quite a bit of work done on the things that you run into, because the crash studies that we had done, where you go out to accident sites and look at what's happened in an accident, really highlighted the fact that some of the heavy street lighting poles that were around were quite lethal in relatively low-speed accidents. And we did quite a bit of work with the manufacturers of poles to look at breakaway bases on the poles and collapsible poles, so that in a crash the pole wouldn't cut through the car, but it will also help to contain the car, to catch it so that it didn't bounce off and create other problems. We also did work on the median barriers that you can put between traffic lanes, because again, those head-on accidents are just so much energy involved that whatever you can do to divert two cars so that they don't come into head-on collision is going to provide a big benefit. And those same barriers can be used around bridge abutments. And it's interesting, when Princess Diana was killed in that crash in Paris, I noticed that there were structures in that tunnel that were exposed that the car crashed into that wouldn't be exposed on our roads in New South Wales, because we had learnt long ago not to have those features where they're exposed to that sort of a crash.
The work done at Tyro was gaining an international reputation.
Much of the work that we did was made use of overseas. After I'd been on a couple of overseas study tours, there was a lot of interest in what was happening in Australia, and people were coming to Australia to see what we were doing. We really were leading what was happening in the world in road safety.
So how large did the team at Tyro grow to?
Pretty substantial number eventually. I should think at our peak we would be between 80 and 90 people. So it was certainly the biggest full-time road safety research group in Australia and one of the biggest in the world.
In 1976, the New South Wales government shifted responsibility for the administration of Tyro from the Department of Motor Transport to a new body, the Traffic Authority, and appointed Harry Kamkin as its director. The future direction of Tyro now came under his banner.
I could see that Tyro had been doing a lot of good work in the preceding 5-6 years, and so I was happy to let that run for the time being until we got a handle on why New South Wales was doing relatively poorly compared with Victoria. Victoria is rapidly establishing a reputation as one of the most up-and-coming road safety states in the world, and we were going backwards. Their accident rate had improved since the early 1970s, and ours was just continuing to rise.
Did you change anything in the general direction of Tyro?
Yes, after a while, when I felt, and I had some good support from other advisors, I felt that they'd passed their heyday in terms of bringing this scientific approach to road safety, and they were becoming a little bit too academic for what we needed in the Traffic Authority. So I wanted them to become more results-oriented and move their research away from the basic or pure research end of the spectrum to the applied end of the spectrum.
Did you have some flack about those ideas?
Well, I certainly did when in the early 1980s I got the commissioner of the day to agree to move the traffic accident research holus bolus over into the Traffic Authority, effectively abolished it. I thought the time has come to break them up as a research unit, but move the individuals, very highly competent individuals, into the Traffic Authority area and work more directly with the people looking for results.
The guy in charge of the Traffic Authority basically set around a minute, which is very well remembered by everyone who worked there, called the Halcyon Days Minute. And it basically said that the Halcyon Days are over.
How do you feel about the closure of Tauru?
You know, from an inside perspective, we never saw it as being closed. All we saw was a change in how it operated. My team was really just pretty much determined to do our job. And we just pretty much just kept doing it.
It was the beginning of my lesson that nothing ever stays the same forever. And quite often it's not for bad reasons, and the change quite often can lead to better outcomes. We did have some very tough times in the laboratory there for a while. All our space was being taken over by storage for stationery. We were down to a few staff, and really had to sort ourselves out, identify what it was that we could do that would add value to the world and get things happening.
Michael Henderson evaluates the impact that Tauru had on road safety.
What we did, I think, was become one of the most influential bodies in reversing the previously inexorable trend of road fatalities and road injuries to go up. Not just us, but we were working with the same kind of vision and the same kind of determination and the same kind of science with other people in Australia and around the world. And we managed, or our influence, was one of the reasons that the road toll did its inverted U-turn. It went over the top in the 70s and then started going down. I'm convinced that it was the application of science at that time, from the late 60s through the 70s, that caused that dramatic turnaround in road safety, which was a pretty dismal prospect when I first came into the field. By the time I left the government, it was no longer a dismal prospect. That looks like the kind of activities, concepts, ideas, research that we were doing in association with others was having a real measurable effect, and that was hugely satisfying.
Before the Traffic Authority was created in 1976, the actual accountability for road safety had been rather haphazard. The Department of Motor Transport and the Department of Main Roads each had a certain level of responsibility. But what was that level? Graeme Brisbane recalls.
The only real level was that there was a set of standards to build a road to, and that's how you should conform. There was what they called the Road Safety Bureau in those days, which was separate, wasn't part of the DMR. And as long as we built a road to the Ausroad standards or the DMR standards, we'd honoured our commitment to road safety. We weren't interested in police enforcement campaigns. We weren't interested in behavioural campaigns. We weren't really interested in new design features. I mean, I came from England, which was full of roundabouts. And in those days, you mentioned roundabouts and people would say, well, why would you want a roundabout in Australia? You know, our road system is fine. I don't think there was an awful lot of thinking about what might be wrong with what we're doing. As long as we followed our guidelines and our standards, how could we be wrong? You know, and that's what we did. And we were engineers, and that's what we were there for. Move dirt, pour concrete, let's get it out there. And we did it well. But it wasn't about road safety in those days. And you've only got to look at the road toll that got to, 1380 in 1978 as an example of the fact that it certainly wasn't a priority, let alone the DMR. It wasn't a priority for government. I mean, the road toll kept going up, and the Road Safety Bureau kept the statistics, but there was very little done about how we get it down.
Car accidents are no longer referred to as such by road safety practitioners, but as preventable incidents. Statistics provide information of when, where, and why crashes occur. So how do statisticians make sense of all the data that they need to analyse? Andy Graham.
It's all about not necessarily looking at the patterns, but discovering variances and deviations from the pattern. So that's what statisticians look for in terms of identifying things in the data. So we look for things which give us an indication of overrepresentation of particular groups. Say, for example, young people or something like that. We can quantify how much different they are, how much more overrepresented, what their increased risk is. But then we can also look at what makes them different from other groups. And once you know what's different about that particular group, then you can start identifying, creating, implementing countermeasures which might address the characteristics. say, for example, young people, they're overrepresented. Young people have a propensity to take risks, e.g. speeding. There's an obvious intervention there to target young people with speeding interventions and get the messages pitched at their level. So that's what we do as statisticians, to sift through the data, identify the interesting characteristics, potential countermeasures, and of course evaluate the effectiveness of measures. Most of the crash data comes from our police reporting. That information is sent to us electronically. We add some information from the Health Department, Division of Analytical Laboratories, which has alcohol information for controllers and other people killed or seriously injured. Some geographic information is coded. We code the Australian map grid reference data, locations, longitude and latitude coordinates for the crash data, so we can plot it on electronic maps and things like that. We then do cross-checks of the data, so we ensure that if the casualties are described as a driver age 40, but there's no traffic unit controllers described as being age 40, then we start doing queries and say, what's the difference in this information? You know, where's the anomaly here? So we do those sort of things with the data. And at the end of it, we've got a record of something like 150 variables with crash information, location stuff, time, date, type of location, road surface conditions, weather, vehicle information or traffic unit information, what sort of traffic unit, what was the age of the driver, what were they doing, what manoeuvres, what errors did they make, and casualties from the crash, if there are casualties from the crash. And they'll have information, age, gender, etc., as well as class of road user and so on. It's quite a comprehensive data record, and there's a lot of work that goes into each one of them. Each year there are about 45,000 crashes entered into the system. That's obviously a huge undertaking by the New South Wales Police and the RTA, but it gives us the information we need to do our work. Of the 45,000 crashes, most of them actually occur in highly congested metro areas of Sydney, Newcastle and Wollongong. Fatal crashes, they're a different story. Around two-thirds of all the state's fatal crashes occur on country roads. It's a bit of a problem for the country people because they only have one-third of the New South Wales population. So they have a disproportionate amount of road trauma in their community.
Are those crashes mainly caused by country drivers, or are they city drivers on country roads that have these crashes?
The fallacy is, according to country residents, is that city drivers don't know how to drive country roads. Well, to some extent that might be true, but the reality is in the stats that most crashes in the country areas involve country drivers. So it's totally wrong to blame the city folk. It's actually country people that are crashing on country roads, and they're usually the ones that are taking the most high-risk behaviours.
Another important figure in the history of road safety in Victoria was Dr. John Birrell. Ian Johnston elaborates.
John was absolutely pivotal. He was the police surgeon. Nowadays they've got several police surgeons. He was the only one. And in the late 60s, early 70s, he was single-handedly responsible for getting politicians to understand the role of alcohol in crashes. One of my favourite newspaper clippings is from 1958, and it was the report of Australian Bureau of Statistics analysis of road crashes. And the headline was, "Careless reversing causes more deaths than alcohol." And you went, what? And anyway, it documented that in the stats, less than 3% of fatal crashes involved alcohol. And John Birrell knew that to be rubbish because he'd get called out on a Saturday night to serious crashes, and every time he'd find grog. And no one would believe him. And the reason it wasn't in the stats is no one ever tested for it. If the guy was dead, you put him in a sheet, took him off to the morgue. If they were taken to hospital, the doctors attempted to stitch him up. The police weren't interested in testing because there was no blood alcohol law. So in order to convict someone, you had to prove that they were affected by alcohol to such an extent that they didn't have proper control. So the whole system was stacked against finding a role for alcohol. So John Birrell took senior Victorian politicians out with him on a Saturday night.
And he demonstrated this?
Oh, he said, come and sniff their breath. And he convinced the government then to do two things. He convinced the coroners to regularly take blood from dead persons, and convinced the doctors at the hospitals to take blood from casualties. And it was enormously important, actually, in emergency medicine to know whether the guy had been drinking, because it affected very much the kind of anaesthetic he gave them to do the operation. And far from the ABS figure of 3%, we found out very quickly from the first series of coroner's data that more than 50% of the dead drivers were over the legal limit. So suddenly we knew what was happening. And I mean, all of that began to spread to the other states as well. But from there, John was one of the key ones in pressing the government to get a blood alcohol law introduced.
John Knott adds,
drinking and driving was accepted. Australia had a reputation as a heavy drinking country, and dear, I could point to adverts for whiskey and beer back in the 20s and 30s and 50s, you know, have one for the road.
The history of blood alcohol laws and the invention of the breathalyzer begins in 1953 with Professor Robert Borkenstein of Indiana State University.
I got to know him passably well, actually, although he's long since passed on. He was a great friend of John Birrell's. Borkenstein did a study called the Grand Rapids Study. It was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was one of the first applications of what's called a case control study. He took a whole lot of crashes and measured the alcohol levels of the crash-involved drivers. Then he went back to the same places where the crashes occurred. So if he had 100 crashes, he'd have 100 sites. And he went back to each one of those on the same day of week under the same weather conditions and stopped 10 drivers at random and got blood samples of them. These are people who didn't have a crash at the same place, same time of day, same day of week, same weather conditions. You look at their alcohol involvement against the ones who did have a crash. And he was able to draw what's called a dose response curve and showed that if you set a zero level of alcohol as one, then when you were at 0.5, it was 2. And if you were at 1.5, it was about 80. So that's really saying that the more you drink, the greater the probability you're going to have a crash. It makes eminent sense today. But what was interesting for governments was, where do you draw the line? What's the legal limit you set? And so the rationale for 0.05 is that is where the risk is double. It doesn't mean that all the alcohol-related crashes happen at 0.05. In fact, most of them happen further up the scale, but it's a social balance. So Borkenstein did this piece of work that, in fact, became the foundation stone for all drink driving per se laws, that is, laws where you're just saying, we're setting a level, end of story.
In South Australia, Jack McLean had devised his own drink drive study at a time before the introduction of random breath testing anywhere in Australia.
In the in-depth study in the mid-1970s, we had our own handheld breath alcohol meters, similar to the ones the police still use, and I wanted to know what drink driving was like in the general population of drivers who weren't involved in accidents. And I wanted to do this without involving the police. So in 1978, we tried putting on a white coat and going out to a set of traffic lights at night. And when a car stopped at a red light, one of us would walk up and say, we're not the police from the university doing a survey on drinking and driving. Would you please blow in this? And to our astonishment, people did. And in the following 20 years, we tested about 80,000 drivers, mostly between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m., with a refusal rate usually of under 5%. And a lot of our colleagues overseas don't believe the refusal rate, but there's nowhere else in the world that had a continuous series of information. And using that technique, we were able to conduct a case control study to show how the risk of crash involvement varied with driver's blood alcohol level. That's one of the more important things we've done.
More on this subject continues on CD number 2.